Hi. We've all heard food is medicine, and hopefully you know now or will after the next 30 minutes that the sun is also medicine. Light is as important as air and water. Richard Hobday, PhD, wrote The Healing Sun, and it's quite amazing to zero in on all Richard has to share. So here comes the sun. Tributaries. I'm Robin Clare. Richard, hi. I found your book, The Healing Sun, and now upon further investigation, I see you visited us in Colorado quite some time ago when you gave a paper on heliotherapy, and I'm sure there's more science now, but has any of your message really changed?
Not really, other than there's more evidence to support it, I would say. When I was researching 30 years ago, there was very little evidence that sunlight had any health benefits at all. Vitamin D was not a concern, and things like circadian rhythms were not really known about. The importance of light on depression and things like that have not really been researched or publicized greatly. And again, there's now more evidence supporting the idea that sunlight is germicidal and therapeutic. So it's fortunately supported what I tried to explain in that book.
Yes, and you also go into a lot of great history. So it was common sense, anecdotal knowledge way, way back in time. And with only a little bit of research now, it's easy to see that open air healing has been successful at curing all types of bacterial and viral diseases. And it's been throughout the ages. And that was one thing you saw visiting in Colorado, the history of the Fitzsimmons Army Hospital, correct?
Yeah, that was built in 1918. It was there for troops coming back from the war with tuberculosis. And it was also used, from what I've read, it was used to treat patients from the influenza pandemic of 1918 as well. So there are photographs of people put outside to recover in the sun and fresh air. Certainly during the pandemic, people recovered outdoors better than people indoors for a variety of reasons. What we know now is that sunlight is antiviral, so there's good scientific evidence to show that it does kill the influenza virus. So if you're out in the fresh air, there's evidence that that kills viruses. And of course, there's all the benefits that you get from being in the sun, from obviously vitamin D and circadian rhythms being entrained and other health benefits that are being explored now that weren't known then.
Yes, and I definitely want to go into both of those points a little later, but I was so very interested to find out historically, going back into centuries BC, that physicians were architects, and architects were encouraged to have knowledge of medicine. And I know you've followed both of these lines of studies, and why is that connection so important?
You tend to find, if you look at the history of it, where you have sun worship, you'd quite often have architecture that not only is involved, obviously, in the worship of the sun, but generally sun worship is closely linked to the worship of the sun as a god or goddess of health. And so you tend to get people have an appreciation of that, and the architecture reflects it to a certain degree. Where sunlight is regarded as therapeutic, the architecture tends to follow. In this country, in Britain, we had a window tax for 150 years. So people didn't get sunlight and fresh air, especially poor people, because they couldn't afford to pay the tax. But that was a period when sunlight and fresh air were not considered important. So it goes generally with medical thinking. And obviously, if you go back to the ancient Egyptians, the first architect we know of was also a great figure of being involved in the sun, built the first pyramid, according to legend. And so it goes on. One of my interests is Roman architecture. And the Romans had right to sunlight laws. You couldn't build and block somebody's access to the sun because they used it to heat their buildings, but also they used it as a medicine. So it was very advanced.
What a difference between the Romans not allowing blocking the sun to the Brits who wanted to tax you for wanting sun. That's unbelievable.
If you go around Britain, you'll see the big old houses all had big windows. And that was the wealthy showing their wealth, because windows were taxed and glass was taxed. So you showed your wealth by having a house with big windows.
And serving sugar, right?
Don't get into that. Yeah.
So, Richard, tell me a little bit about how today you would go about building something to really get the most out of sun.
It's a bit complicated in the sense that you'd have to go around building a building very differently from the way they are today. The most important thing to look at, I would say, if I'm lecturing to architecture students, is check the orientation of your building and check the orientation of your city. Because if you look in history, the people who knew how to build for the health benefits of the sun didn't build a north, south, east, west. They always built off axis. So the important thing is to be able to get the sun coming in from the southeast, obviously in northerly latitudes. I'm not talking about the southern hemisphere. If you go back and read Hippocrates, he said, oh, face it southeast, your city is basically what he says, and then you'll have fewer sick people in it. And that's true today. And it's the same with buildings. If you get early morning sun in, the chances are that it's going to be a healthier building, not just inside the building, but around the building, because it means in the winter that you don't get damp. If you have a building that faces due south, which is the way that a lot of buildings and cities are, it means that the sun doesn't get around the back in the winter to clear your snow or your damp away. So that's the basis of designing a healthy building, is check your orientation first. And then you get into the business of accepting the sun into the building and fresh air and how you heat it. Because the other problem you've got these days is that I would argue buildings today are designed for comfort rather than health, or energy efficiency rather than health. Whereas if you go back to people like Florence Nightingale, she said, well, what you must do is get plenty of fresh air in, sunlight in, and you should heat with a radiant heat source. Shouldn't heat with warm air, you should heat with a radiant heat source, which is very much against the modern way of doing it, certainly in this country.
I'm sure it's a worldwide problem at this point, right? In your book, you bring up so many great points, scientific and anecdotal. And I'm wondering if you could share first the difference between deficiency and insufficiency and why it's an important distinction to make.
I'd love to be able to help you there, but I'm not an expert on vitamin D, I have to say. And there's a big debate about what constitutes deficiency and what constitutes insufficiency since I wrote that book. So I would advise anybody interested in that to go and see what the experts in vitamin D are saying. That's a very controversial subject. If you're talking about supplementation or anything like that, then you need to know what you're looking at. And when I wrote that book, vitamin D deficiency wasn't even considered a problem then. And now it's known as a global pandemic. A billion people worldwide are deficient. But again, how you define deficiency depends on who you talk to.
Of course. And just the fact that you were talking about it quite a few years ago does mean something. And I think it does refer back to your own expertise. I don't think, correct me if you know, optimal amounts, I don't think they're even agreed upon, really, are they?
No.
Right.
I mean, when I wrote that, the maximum was 1,200 international units, was considered the maximum you should ever take. But you'll read people say, oh, it's perfectly safe to take 10,000 now. You know, obviously, you have to be careful if you've got underlying health problems, what you do. But I do know if you go out in the sun, your body regulates how much vitamin D you get. So you can't get too much vitamin D from the sun, that's for sure.
Yes, and there are so many problems with synthetic vitamin D. It causes calcium to start flowing in the blood, which wreaks havoc in the entire system. It draws it out of the bone, and then calcium in the blood will start depositing in joints, and it will make walls of the vessels thicker, creating more problems for the heart and pumping and everything else. So it's a great point that the body can regulate it when you're getting it naturally through the sun.
From what the experts say, you can take large doses of vitamin D safely as long as you know what you're doing. The point I would make is that there is a big difference between sunlight and vitamin D. If you look at those sort of hospitals that were built for sunlight therapy, if they could have done everything that they did with sunlight, with vitamin D, they wouldn't have needed to bother building the hospitals, if you follow me.
Of course.
When I wrote my book, what I'd forgotten, after it went off to the publishers, my dear elderly mother turned to me and said, you do realize you had sunlight therapy as a child, don't you? And I suddenly remembered that I had. And it was too late to put in the book.
Tell us that story now.
When I was very small, I developed an infection, and my parents took me to the family doctor who tried various things, and it was, in effect, it was a drug-resistant infection. And so I believe she'd been in the Royal Army Medical Corps during the war. So she knew about the use of sunlight. And she said, I'll put him out in the sun. So I spent the summer out in the sun getting rid of a drug-resistant infection. And it was very similar to the treatment that gained Niels Finsen the Nobel Prize for Medicine in 1903. He got it for tuberculosis, and I didn't have tuberculosis. I don't know what it was. I can't remember. But I remember being out in the sun getting rid of it.
Yes. And it's interesting to hear that 60 years ago, there was an antibiotic-resistant disease going on. People make that sound like that's something new.
No, it's always been around. You read Fleming, who led the discovery of antibiotics, and colleagues of his and he, I think, said, oh, yeah, they're going to be very quick to become resistant. So it's not like people didn't know that it was going to happen. And obviously, I wrote about it in that book 20 years ago, saying antibiotic resistance is going to be a problem, and we ought to look at what was used before. I've got a paper, and it said, well, tuberculosis is now so resistant, we're going to have to look at using sunlight therapy again.
What's old is new again, right, Richard?
Yeah. I guess what makes me slightly different is I like to study the history of things, and that's partly because I'm an engineer by training. In engineering, it's considered very bad form to do what we refer to as reinventing the wheel.
Oh, yes. I love that. And that's why it's so important to work with things from a multidisciplinary approach, right? Because everything...
Yeah, very much so.
Yeah. Yeah, amazing.
Yeah, very much so. If you leave it to one discipline, it's very limited in its outlook. Whereas if you bring disciplines together, as long as they understand what each other's saying, and that's part of the problem, is that they speak different languages. It might be English, but it's not necessarily English that each other understands, you know?
And I think that definitely feeds back into when we were talking about, well, what is the optimal dose of vitamin D? I think the word optimal and the word normal start figuring into blind averages. So it's skewed from the beginning, unless you can bring in lots of other factors.
What is optimal for one person isn't necessarily optimal for another.
Exactly.
When they were doing sunlight therapy, the experts at sunlight therapy with very ill patients, they tailored the treatment with sunlight very closely to the needs of each individual patient.
Perfect.
And how they responded, because if they got it wrong, they killed them. It was a very, very carefully tailored form of medicine. They didn't just go around saying, right, you're ill, you're going to have 2 hours sunlight. You know, that would have finished a lot of the patients off.
Right. And I love that they just got very involved and took a very scientific approach to having someone be in the sunlight. I just love that piece of information. You talk about the solar and lunar calendars in your book and how they all play into getting the most out of our time in the sun. And I'm wondering, how does that play into the fact that the sun is a hormonal and biochemical regulator?
That's getting a bit beyond me. I just wrote really about how people looked at the sun and understood natural cycles a bit better than perhaps we do now. And the other thing I found later on, I didn't really appreciate, was that if you go back in history, the sun was feminine and the moon was masculine. And that came as quite a shock when I dug that one out. That was not something I'd ever been taught. And then I suddenly discovered that this whole culture of sun worshipping the sun as a goddess was quite a sort of cultural shift for me.
Mm.
Not that it's a bad thing, far from it. You know, I think it's great to have a different perspective on it. The Egyptians were worshipping the sun as a god and as a goddess. The idea is still in Japan. The sun is still worshipped as a goddess in Japan. And... many parts of the world used to, at one time, worship the sun as a goddess.
Right.
There's all sorts of routes you can go down with this research.
I definitely like the one where it's a god and a goddess, because I think ultimately they all incorporate the yin and the yang.
Yeah, they had both, the Egyptians.
I know you've written about myopia, and I just think for the sake of our children, let's do all we can, and especially with schools and... I know you've written about myopia, and I'm wondering if you would share a little bit about that today with us.
Well, some of my research, sort of 30 years ago, was looking at school design, and that's really how I got into this. And I was going around looking at schools, and a lot of old schools had big windows, and I couldn't work out why they got big windows. And I'd see occasionally references to children's eyesight, but I couldn't find anything about it, because by the time I was looking at it, the idea that light affected children becoming short-sighted was considered a medical myth, if you like. So it took me 30 years to find a research paper from Germany published in 1867, which said a survey of 10,000 children, myopia, short-sightedness is most common in children in urban rather than rural areas. Children who study most intensively have it, and children in the darkest classrooms have it. So from 1867 onwards, classrooms were designed to try and stop myopia, short-sightedness, by having big windows, and that went on till the 1960s. So when I was at schools in Britain, there was still a legal requirement to have a minimum daylight level in classrooms to stop children becoming short-sighted. And eventually I found out that that's what it was. There was a belief that daylight in classrooms would stop children becoming short-sighted. And that's why, I think that's why we were encouraged to get out of the classrooms at all times between lessons to make sure that we didn't get short-sighted. And of course, research being published now confirms what was suggested in 1867.
Boy, there was such a skipping of really good common sense information that went on as the industrial age progressed. What was the most mind-blowing thing you found when you started studying heliotherapy or how important the sun was?
I think it was really the fact that it had been used so widely. And like the First World War, when... You know, some estimates are that 50% of casualties during the First World War died of infections. They didn't die of the wounds. They died because the wounds became infected or they got caught in infection. And the fact that many of the hospitals were built to treat war wounded with sunlight, and I'd never heard of that. You know, obviously you knew that they didn't have antibiotics, they didn't have very good disinfectants, so what did they do? And, of course, the German army had hospitals in the Black Forest for sunlight therapy, and troops were sent to Switzerland for sunlight therapy treatment for the wounds. So it was very widespread, but of course it's a part of medical history that people don't know about. I certainly didn't.
Right. What are some of the benefits that people get from the sun as far as medical conditions that you wrote about or that you discovered in your research?
There are some that are still practiced, of course, things like psoriasis. People are still sent to the Dead Sea or places like that for sunlight treatment, and they seem to get better with that than they do with other forms of treatment. But, of course, if you go back, the bone disease, rickets, I don't know what it was like. Probably you didn't have very much in Denver or Boulder because it's very sunny, but you're talking about 80% of children had rickets in London, in the East End of London, really at the beginning of the 20th century, and it was a crippling bone disease. And then from 1921 onwards, sunlight was used to treat rickets, and tuberculosis was the other big one that was treated, but there are many other diseases that were treated, and obviously this goes back a long, long way, that people were using it to treat things. But the other one I found was, of course, in babies born prematurely, their livers can't detoxify their blood so well, so they're given light treatment for it, light therapy. And, of course, that was sunlight therapy they were given to detoxify the blood. So it's a long, long list. But, of course, not one that you've got to go back a long way to find a lot of these things. And it isn't used that widely now. But as I say, if antibiotics become more resistant, then, as I suggested at the end of that book, let's hope we don't have to use sunlight again. But it looks like we might have to.
Yes, I hope there are a lot of folks relying on that today with this pandemic that we're all experiencing worldwide.
Yeah, well, I mean, having sort of investigated that and found a hospital where they used fresh air and sunlight on it, it's quite clear from the literature that sunlight is virucidal. It will kill viruses. Whether it kills coronavirus or not, I don't know. But it is a very powerful virucidal agent, and fresh air is virucidal as well. So if you're out in the fresh air, there is evidence, it's in the scientific literature, that fresh air will kill viruses. So it stands to reason then that when they tried it in 1918, they had some success with it.
There are so many spectrums to light, and with artificial lighting, which not unlike vitamin D supplementation, we have side effects from that. I know that artificial lighting negatively affects our adrenals, for one. And I'm wondering, what kind of light do you live in? What kind of lights do you have in your home, and how much attention do you pay to that now?
Well, I did experiment with it at one time. I try to use incandescent bulbs, actually, and use as much daylight as I can. And I will risk using a candle occasionally and just sit in candlelight before I go to bed. I mean, the one thing I do try and do is make sure I'm in darkness before I go to sleep. You know, I don't have bright light before I go to sleep. That's the important thing. I mean, if you go back to hospitals years and years ago, I don't know what it's like in America, but years ago here, hospital blinds were always down at night to make sure it was dark. And if you read the sunlight therapists, one of them, the British one, Sir Henry Gavain, said, darkness is as important in the therapy as light. So the idea was that you're in darkness and then you got the light. It was that contrast that helped you get better. Whereas in hospitals, certainly in this country, there's low-level light on all the time. So patients tend to get somewhat disorientated, especially in intensive care units, because they don't have the triggers that reset their biological rhythm. So I think it's really about getting the right light levels at the right time. As to the spectrum, well, obviously, the nearer you can get to the natural spectrum, the better, I would say. But again, you need an expert on that, and I'm not one.
It's so brilliant that you just mentioned the difference between the light and the dark and the importance of having that. So it's important, it seems, to have darkness before you go to sleep, not just when you're going to sleep.
Yeah, you need to tell your body it's time to go to sleep. I mean, if you consider, for example, many, many years that the human race in their various forms have been outside at night or in a cave or in a hut or whatever or in a house, and they've been in front of a radiant heat source, a fire. So that's most of our existence. We've lived at night in front of a fire. So I would imagine that that's basically what we're tuned to, something of that light level. A radiant heat source, but also one that doesn't produce enough light to disrupt our circadian rhythms, is what we were exposed to before we went to sleep. So you really don't want to go to sleep having exposed yourself to something that emulates daylight. And of course, as I said, in hospitals, you know, Florence Nightingale, very famous in this country. I don't know about America.
Oh, she is here too.
Ladies. She is as well, yeah. Well, I've written about her quite a bit, and she knew what she was talking about a lot of the time. And she was known as the Lady of the Lamp, because, of course, in those days, nurses used to go around a dark hospital with a lamp. They didn't turn the lights on.
Right. I would love to see that shift going on for everyone. I could see how that could make a big difference.
Yeah, but that's how it was, you know. And, of course, she said the windows must be kept open day and night. And what she meant by that was you've got to get rid of your, because of course in those days hospitals were full of people who had infections. So she said you've got to get your windows open day and night. And of course she insisted on a radiant heat source as well, you see, so she could have a lot of air blowing through, because the heat wasn't heating the air, it was heating the fabric of the building and the people inside it.
Right.
There's only one genius I think I've ever read in all the time I've been doing my research, I would say unreservedly, Florence Nightingale.
Oh, well, that's lovely. I love that. Richard, you're so knowledgeable, and you wrote a book about the healing sun, and there's a lot of brilliant information in there. So I have to beg to differ when you say I need to speak to an expert. You've done quite a lot of research and have quite a bit of knowledge. But knowing that you are an engineer, is there something you'd like to say about that? I feel like there's a huge part of you that we're not even touching today. So is there something you'd like to say about that part of your life?
I would only say that I studied engineering for 8 years. So I did a master's, I did a PhD, and then after that, the 8 years, I did 2 years postdoctoral. So I've had it drummed into me, if you like, and my father is an engineer, my brother, and, or, you know, family. And there is a certain mindset that comes with it. And there are two things I would say that distinguish it. One is what you're really interested in is what works. Theories and mathematical models are fine, but at the end of the day, if you turn the key and press the button, it's got to go. If you follow me?
Yes, yes.
So you're interested in what works or what doesn't. And the second thing, as I said before, is it's in engineering, if you do what I said before, if you design and build something and present it, and then somebody taps you on the shoulder and says, you do realize that that was invented, built, and designed 150 years ago. That would not be good for your career.
Yes, and the wheel definitely works.
Yeah, and that's basically, yeah, do not reinvent the wheel. Like if I said now, we've got an emergency on with this pandemic, I'll put together an emergency hospital for you. It'd be prefabricated. Two men will be able to build this hospital. It will take 30 patients. It will be cross-ventilated. It will have a supplementary mechanical ventilation system. I'll put a roof on that reflects the sun because it's going to be built somewhere really sunny. What do you think? I built it. What do you think? And they tap me on the shoulder and say, well, actually, Isambard Kingdom Brunel built one of those for the Crimea War in 1854.
But
right?
That
it was copied by your armies in the American Civil War and by the Prussian and German armies afterwards. If I did that, it would not look very good.
But it doesn't mean we couldn't use it at this point in time, right?
I think it would be a very valuable thing to have, to be honest, because the death rates in those are very low. But, yeah, but I'm just illustrating the point, you know?
Of course.
That's something, and I'm talking from the position of having made that mistake. So it's not something I'm immensely proud about talking about, but I have made that mistake. And I've also relied too heavily on, well, not necessarily too heavily, but I have relied on mathematical models that subsequently proved not to be quite as reliable as they appeared to be. So I speak from a bit of experience.
Yes, well, that's innovation right there. Many thanks to Richard Hobday, author of The Healing Sun. For any guest information, to listen to archives, share resources, or sign up for weekly programming, it's tributariesradio.wordpress.com. Podcasts are on iTunes as Tributaries Radio, and Google, too, now, I believe. I'm Robin Clare. Thanks for staying tuned.